I entered this world 3 days before Christmas in 1973. I had somewhat of a normal upbringing in a small town near Toronto, Canada. I went to public school in the 1980s, and I eventually left high school out of boredom at age 16. At this time, the Cold War had just ended, and Desert Storm, the first Gulf War, was just getting underway. Even at such a young age, I somehow knew that what I was being taught at school was not exactly the whole truth. Upon leaving school, I immediately applied for a social insurance number and joined the workforce. Being young and full of energy, I took any job that managed to fall into my lap, such as a short order cook, a carnival ride operator, and even front office work at a recording studio, where, at age 19, I was witnessing up-and-coming Canadian rock bands signing multi-million dollar recording contracts. As with everyone else, society incorrectly instilled in me at a very early age that earning money was apparently the entire meaning of human life on this planet. Money represented everything of importance to my human existence, including my food, my clothing, my housing, and yes, even my ability to attract girlfriends. So, if money was at the core of my existence, and provided for the basics to sustain human life in a humanitarian-based nation such as Canada, it made me question why then Prime Minister Brian Mulroney introduced GST, a 7% federal sales tax on every good and service that I paid for. This was on top of the 8% provincial sales tax and 22% income tax that I was already paying, and it amounted to a grand total of 37% taxation on my right to human life. But after the 1991 recession that was apparently brought on by the Gulf War, life went on for me, and I just had to get used to the idea of accepting a lower standard of living in a country that is unbelievably rich in natural resources. Fast forward 10 years and several job changes later, as with most people, my life was changed forever by the horrific events of September 11, 2001. While attempting to get ready for work that day, I watched the buildings fall on live TV. Even at the time, I felt that something was off. But I went to work that day, and by the time I came home, Bush was on TV supplying us with the official narrative. Fast forward 7 years, 4 maxed out credit cards, and 2 divorces later, in October 2008, a coworker emailed me a Google video link to a documentary film. This film was called Terror Storm, a history of government-sponsored terrorism. That night, I sat down at my computer with a 6-pack of beer and an open mind, and I watched the whole thing. This film blew my mind, as I just could not get out of my head the possibility of having been lied to about 9/11. Having watched and been inspired by Alex's films, in 2009, I began creating my own films by using other people's YouTube videos and compiling them into an understandable and educational experience, detailing the events of 9/11 and the New World Order as a whole. From that moment on, the word truth replaced the word money as the core of my human existence. And the word freedom became my ultimate goal. So why am I telling you all of this? Because without truth, you can never have freedom. After nearly 5 years of persistent research into the truth of the New World Order and the systems of law which govern it, I now have a more complete picture, which I would like to share with you. The New World Order is not at all what I originally thought it was when I embarked on my journey of truth and freedom in 2008. The real truth of the matter is that every town, every city, every region, every county, and every municipality in North America is in fact a municipal corporation, chartered by a state or province since about the mid-1800s. A municipal corporation is defined in law as a city, town, or other local political entity, a public corporation formed by charter from the state and having the autonomous authority to administer the state's local affairs. A municipal corporation that has legal operating authority over the land that I live upon is called the Corporation of the City of Toronto, and it was incorporated in 1834. Every state and every province in North America is also a corporation, chartered by their respected countries. Now here is where things get very deceptive.
What we have to look at is the president is the chief executive officer of this corporation called the United States of America.
What did you just say?
The president is the chief executive officer of this corporation called the United States of America.
Near the end of World War II, the United Nations was created in 1945, with one of its main intentions being to secure a governing body that could legally issue charters of incorporation to all 193 countries now operating under the UN Charter, and to be able to regulate these nation-state corporations via the authoritarian financial control of the IMF. The process of nation-state incorporation has been long and drawn out, slowly transpiring over the last 50 years. For example, Canada did not officially become its own corporate entity until the 17th of April, 1982. At this point, the Constitution Act was amended and transformed into a corporate charter, adding to it the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, a document of incorporation that only applies to employees of this new corporate government. In fact, if you look up Canada on the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission website, you will find it there, listed as a company. This company lists income tax payments as a stream of revenue. Ever since 2008, the entire premeditated plan of the ongoing European Union financial collapse has been to bankrupt the nations of Europe, forcing them to sign on to the IMF's bailout packages, and thereby transforming them all into corporations in one foul swoop. Daniel Estlin, author of The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, was 100% correct when he entitled his 2010 address to the European Parliament Towards One World Company Limited. The ultimate plan of the New World Order's think tanks, such as Bilderberg Group, is to turn everything on this planet, including you, into a profit-making corporation, governed by the rules and bylaws of business. One vast and ecumenical holding company, for whom all men will work to serve a common profit, as Ned Beatty's character promoted in the 1976 film Network. In 1965, David Rockefeller addressed the International Industrial Conference, where he boldly stated, "We have entered upon an era in which interdisciplinary cooperation on a worldwide basis must be the cornerstone of accomplishment. Each of us has the duty to fashion his own contribution to fit the grand design of a global community." For many of us, the marketplace of tomorrow will be no less than this whole planet of Earth. What we do will manifest itself in ways that we cannot foretell, and it will have an unforeseen impact on individual lives and whole societies. What we are is God's gift to man. What we become is man's gift to God. The very moment one gets over the shock of realizing that countries are now merely corporations, trading the natural resources of the planet, you then also come to the realization of one other very important concept. Corporations have absolutely no control or authority over any human being without their consent.
Government of the people and by the people. sets a single standard for all who would hold power. You must maintain your power through consent, not coercion.
Consent is defined as agreement, approval, or permission as to some act or purpose given voluntarily by a competent person. Since the created can never be greater than the creator, the elite knew that they could not give corporations all of the legal rights of human beings. So, they had to devise a scheme by which, over time, they could achieve parity by reducing our human rights down to the level of the legal rights of a corporation. For hundreds of years, human beings have been represented in law by the legal status known as a person. In 1888, however, the Supreme Court ruled that the word person, as it appears in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, includes corporations. Within a few short years, law dictionaries had redefined the word person, splitting it into two subcategories, natural person and artificial person. A natural person is defined in law as a human being who has the legal capacity for rights and duties. An artificial person is defined in law as an entity such as a corporation, created by law and given certain legal rights and duties of a human being. A being, real or imaginary, who, for the purpose of legal reasoning, is treated more or less as a human being. An artificial person is always identified in law by its legal name, written entirely in block capital letters. Shortly after the Great Depression and President Roosevelt's 1933 New Deal, state governments began issuing birth certificates with the name of the registered child in block capital letters. This process didn't commence in Canada until the 1960s. The birth certificate is the founding document from which all other forms of government-issued ID are created. By issuing the birth certificate in the all-capitalized legal name of the artificial person, the elite have achieved their goal of reducing our human rights down to the level of the legal rights of a corporation. Everything you apply for using the birth certificate as the founding document also displays the artificial all-caps name. Documents such as your passport, driver's license, vehicle registration, social security card, bank accounts, credit cards, court documents, tax documents, and even school registration. They all apply only to the artificial person and not to you, the natural person. The only reason why any of these documents and accounts apply to you is because somewhere along the line, you have given your consent to represent the artificial person. Therefore, you are now receiving any benefits associated with that name, but you are also responsible for any liabilities that name incurs. In this system they have created, the liabilities of the artificial person's name will always outweigh the benefits you may receive, because it is a rigged game, completely designed to control and enslave you. Soon, every American will be required to register their biological property in a national system designed to keep track of the people, and that will operate under the ancient system of pledging. Americans, by unknowingly or unwittingly delivering the bills of lading to us, will be rendered bankrupt and insolvent, secured by their pledges. They will be stripped of their rights and given a commercial value designed to make us a profit. After all, this is the only logical way to fund government, by floating liens and debts to the registrants in the form of benefits and privileges. Colonel Edward Mandel House. The truth is, you, as a human being, are not obligated in any way, shape, or form to register your children with or to any corporate government entity. The word registrant is legally defined as a person who registers something for the purpose of securing a right or privilege granted by law upon official registration. When your parents registered your birth, they weren't registering you per se. Shortly after your birth, the hospital took a mandatory blood sample. That blood sample contains your DNA, which is considered under law to be your biological property.
So what if I told you the government has your baby's DNA? Newborns are routinely screened for a series of genetic diseases, and in some states, that DNA is stored even without your consent.
While in the hospital, the baby's heel will be pricked and 5 drops of blood are collected. A couple weeks later, another 5 drops of blood are taken at the pediatrician's office and sent to the state. Now, the newborn screening process only used 1 or 2 of the spots. So what happens to the remaining samples? Well, the state keeps them.
I didn't know that. I think a lot of parents know that our kids get tested for certain genetic diseases, but we don't necessarily know that that DNA is kept in a state lab with our child's name attached.
Upon registration with the government, a trust was created in the name of your artificial person. This trust contains not only that DNA sample, but also your share of any profits made from the government's raping and pillaging of the natural resources of the country. A trust is a legally binding contract between the grantor, your parents, and the trustee, the government, in order to provide the benefits and security to you, the beneficiary. Whenever a trust is created, the title to any property listed in that trust is split. The government was granted the legal title to your DNA, while your parents maintain the equitable title. Legal title refers to the duties and responsibilities of maintaining and controlling some property. Equitable title refers to the benefits and enjoyment of that property.
Some states keep that DNA indefinitely. It'll be there forever.
Don't you have to ask permission, though, to do this?
They passed a new law that allows the state to keep and use the samples for research, but requires parents to be notified and allows parents to request that their child's blood spots be destroyed. But it's not as simple as checking off a box when the samples are taken. Parents must fill out this special form. Then the state has 60 days to destroy the leftover blood spots.
But in other states, there is no such form. You can try writing a letter, but I've talked to several experts on there, and they're kind of like, good luck. I mean, you can write the letter, but the state doesn't have to listen to you. They can just keep storing it.
Now holding the legal title, the government has the responsibility and legal duty to maintain and control the child's DNA. The parents merely have the legal right to the enjoyment of the child that houses that DNA and the benefits of government financial assistance, such as welfare, subsidized housing, and health care. Since the government has the legal duty to maintain and control the child, if you, as the grantor to the trust, fail to take care of their property, the government has the legal right to remove that property from your possession. The same process is true whether you register your child, your vehicle, your firearms, and even your pets. The act of registration creates a trust and transfers the legal title of any property named in that trust to the government. Now here's the catch. The equitable title to your DNA that your parents once held was automatically transferred to you on your 18th birthday. However, the government maintains the legal title over your DNA and thus over you through the artificial person until the day you die, or until you demand in writing to dissolve this trust agreement and take full and legal possession of both halves of the title. Again, the simple fact is, you as a human being are not obligated in any way, shape, or form to register your children or your private property to any corporate government entity. Your artificial person does have an obligated legal duty to register under statute. However, as I've discovered, legal duties can be discharged simply by denial of consent in writing. Just the same as registration, the act of applying for a license from a corporate government entity is also detrimental to your human freedom. the word license is legally defined as a permission, usually revocable, to commit some act that would otherwise be completely lawful to do outside of that licensing framework. Otherwise, that licensing authority would be guilty of fraud for charging money to permit unlawful acts. When you submit, it legally means you are agreeing to bend to the will of another. When you apply, it legally means you are begging for something. So, when you submit an application for a license, it literally means you are begging the government for permission, and you are agreeing to bend to their will in order to get that permission. When you ask for permission to do something that is already lawful, that makes you a child in the eyes of the law. Only children beg for permission to engage in an activity that an adult can do without permission. Specifically, when you apply for a driver's license and put your signature to this contract, you then bind yourself to all of the rules of this contract. This means the moment you receive your license, you are now legally required under statute to register your motor vehicle to the corporate government entity, which then creates a trust, authorizing them to transfer the legal title of that vehicle in order to allow them to be able to tow and impound your car at your own financial expense. Again, the liabilities far outweigh the benefits. If you learned how to properly operate your father's truck on his farmland and never actually applied for a driver's license, then you would not be subject to any statute requiring you to register your vehicle to the government. A common misconception is that law is all-encompassing and that we must obey every law on the books at all times. Nothing is further from the truth. Law is comprised of several different components, many of which only apply to you when you are engaged in an activity for which you contracted with the government in order to gain their permission. These types of laws are not actually laws at all. They are statutes. The word statute has been interpreted to mean a legislative rule of society, which has been given the force of law by the consent of the governed. In plain English, this means that statutes have no lawful force or effect on any human being without your consent. Statutes are very easy to spot because they will always have the word act right in the title, such as the Patriot Act. The easiest way to differentiate between a statute and a law is to always remember that a true law exists only to protect the public and can never compel a free human being to pay or perform. Statutes always compel you to either pay or perform, and sometimes both. Because statutes need your consent in order to give them the force of law, many of them involve a contract, such as a license or a permit. In order to act upon a human being using a statute that has no underlying contract bearing your signature, the police must see your government-issued ID before they act. The simple act of producing your ID for the police to bear witness not only verifies to them the existence of a person who is subject to the statute, but also constitutes the consent needed in order to give that statute the force of law. Remember, the all-capitalized name on your government-issued ID is not you. It is an artificial person that you are falsely identifying with. When police press charges against you, they are actually charging the assumed name of the artificial person, which you have consented to represent. When you show up in court, if you do not immediately correct the assumption of that fictional name, the court will proceed under the presumption that you are in fact that artificial person, and they will grant you all of the rights that artificial persons are entitled to. What this means is you have just consented to being stripped of your human rights in that courtroom. Many statutory laws also have statutory courts, which are usually separate from criminal courts of law. Have you ever wondered why there are tax courts, traffic courts, and family courts? Tax, traffic, and family courts only deal with matters pertaining to those contracts that you have entered into with the government. When dealing with these three types of courts, the name on the originating contract is the all-capitalized name of the artificial person. Therefore, the court will not allow you to rebut this name, as in these courts, the validity of that name is no longer an assumption, but rather it is considered to be an established fact. There is no such thing as human rights in these courts, and as such, you have no constitutional right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty. Artificial persons do not have a soul or a conscience, and something that does not have a soul or a conscience cannot possibly have innocence. As I mentioned before, I applied for a social insurance number when I was 16 because, like everyone else, I was told that I needed this number in order to work legally in Canada. However, what I have come to understand is that the word for is closer to the truth. Given that Canada became a corporation in 1982, it would be more accurate to state that I needed this number in order to work legally for Canada. If you are working legally in Walmart, are you not also working legally for Walmart? The deception of this number is achieved through your ignorance of the type of contract that you are working under. It may sound harsh to say this, but their deception can't work without your ignorance. If you are working under your artificial person's number, it is called a contract of service. This is a three-way contract between you, the government, and your employer, which works on the same principles as a temporary job placement agency. They place you into a job, and for this service, you must give them a portion of your wages. The same is true when working under this number. The alternative to a contract of service is called a contract for hire. This is a legally written two-way private contract between you and your employer, which eliminates the middleman and excludes third-party interlopers from making any claims over the terms or benefits of this contract. This type of contract is what I have worked under for many years now, and as a result, I have not paid a single penny in income tax. As my artificial person is not a party to this contract, nor is the government. As you are beginning to see, the system the elite have created is actually one of two systems running simultaneously side by side. The names of these two systems are listed on the face of every denomination of American paper currency. This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. The public system is governed by commercial law and encompasses everything that you do in society while acting as the representative for your artificial person. Everything from banking to driving, from paying property tax to going to school, from voting in elections to working under your Social Security card. The public system is designed by the elite, and it exists because they consider you to be a child who needs protection from others, as well as protection from yourself. Don't get me wrong, there are many benefits to operating within the public system. However, as I said before, the liabilities far outweigh the benefits. The other side of the coin is the private system. This system is for adults and operates under natural law, which is governed by morality and mutual respect for basic human rights. Nowadays, it is primarily used for private transactions. What the elite don't want you to know is that nearly everything that your artificial person can do in the public system, you, as a human being, have the lawful right to do in the private system. You can earn a tax-free living. You can travel in your unregistered car without begging for permission. You can get married in the eyes of your creator without needing a license. You can homeschool your unregistered children. And you can live a life free of all of the bureaucratic nuisances of a de facto corporate government. Having already learned that one of the main objectives of the New World Order is to convert all 193 countries operating under the UN Charter into corporations, it should come as no surprise that the elite also conceived of a way for these nation-state corporations to enslave human beings without dishonoring a single human right listed within any pre-existing constitution or bill of rights. This ambitious goal was achieved through the 1888 legal creation of the artificial person. However, its true roots date back to the end of the American Civil War and the 1865 passage of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. Most people think the only intention of the 13th Amendment was to abolish slavery. However, if one examines the wording carefully, they will discover an underlying double meaning. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude. What this was actually saying was that ever since 1865, voluntary servitude was now a perfectly legal concept. Voluntary servitude is defined in law as the act of volunteering to be a servant or a slave. The cold hard truth is, if you are using a birth certificate or any document derived from it as your identification, then you are in fact engaged in voluntary servitude. Servitude to your government. The word citizen is defined in law as a person who owes allegiance to a political community. The word allegiance is defined in law as a citizen's obligation of fidelity and obedience to the government in return for the benefits of the protection of the state. The public system that the elite have created has legally enabled them to successfully turn the tables of power in their favor. For the last 800 years, ever since the 1215 creation of the Magna Carta, human beings were meant to be the masters, and government was meant to be our servant. Instead, they have legally flipped it, so that, through our artificial person, the government is now the master. And we are now its voluntary servants. Upon discovering this fact, I was outraged, as this was the complete opposite of everything that I was taught in school and through the mainstream media. However, rather than just becoming another uneducated anarchist, as so many do, I decided to use this information to my own advantage, and I began studying the systems of law that govern us but also govern the elite, what they can do and what they cannot do. As the recently released WikiLeaks cables revealed, the illegal we do immediately. The unconstitutional takes a little longer. Former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, March 10, 1975. To understand the present, we must first understand the past. Given that Canada is a much younger country than the United States of America, it is also much easier to comprehend its laws and constitutional documents. With the passage of the British North America Act, Canada officially became a country under the rule of the British monarchy in 1867. Only 2 years after the end of the American Civil War, and a mere 2 decades before the inception of the legal concept known as an artificial person. Soon after the adoption of the British North America Act as Canada's constitution, the winds of political change began blowing as whispers of a new world order grew louder and louder. Towards the turn of the 20th century, the elite began to see that the old world order of kings and queens ruling over peasants was nearing its end. They began floating the idea of creating a world government that had the power to turn countries into corporations and citizens into employees, otherwise known as voluntary servants. In order to have the appearance of plausible deniability, European royalty was forced to agree to relinquish their power to overtly govern any nation not within their kingdom. By 1926, King George V hosted an imperial conference, the outcome of which was the Balfour Declaration. This declaration proposed that all countries within the realm of the British Empire be declared autonomous communities, separate from British rule. 5 years later, in December 1931, the British Parliament enacted the Statute of Westminster, which effectively removed the ability of the British Parliament to legislate for Canada. However, provisions listed within the statute prevented Canada from truly becoming an autonomous community until 1982. In 1945, the United Nations was formed out of the ashes of World War II. The public face of the United Nations is that of a humanitarian organization operating for the benefit and betterment of mankind. The private face, however, is that of an ever-expanding bureaucratic framework for a future world government. Believe it or not, the elite do have their own moral and ethical code of conduct that they must adhere to. In order to accomplish the goal of stripping us of our human rights, they first felt morally compelled to put down on paper, for all to read, a list of our human rights that were about to be removed through the use of the artificial person. In 1948, the United Nations unveiled the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
We stand today at the threshold of a great event, both in the life of the United Nations and in the life of mankind. This Universal Declaration of Human Rights may well become the international Magna Carta of all men everywhere. We hope its proclamation by the General Assembly will be an event comparable to the proclamation of the Declaration of the Rights of Man by the French people in 1789.
In legal terms, it should have actually been titled the Universal Declaration of Natural Person Rights, as human beings are not technically recognized in law except when they are dead. A clear example of this is expressed in Section 222 of the Criminal Code of Canada under the heading Homicide. A person commits homicide when, directly or indirectly, by any means, he causes the death of a human being. When a person causes the death of a human being, just think about that. In law, human beings are represented by the legal status known as a person, which is derived from the Latin persona, meaning mask, such as a mask used by actors in a theater production. Once you understand the legalese being used, reading the Universal Declaration of Human Rights becomes as easy as reading a tabloid magazine. For example, in the preamble, it states,
"Whereas the peoples of the United Nations have in the Charter reaffirmed their faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person."
What is a human person? It is the mask of a human being represented in law, otherwise known as a natural person. In fact, 29 out of the 30 articles in the Declaration of Human Rights are represented by the natural person. Article 1 is actually the only place in which you are actually referred to as a human being.
all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience, and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood.
All human beings are born free. That statement says it all. However, through your birth certificate, within a few days of your birth, your parents signed you up to become a registered voluntary servant, legally known as a citizen, who owes allegiance and obedience to the government. What is extremely important to note is that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a legal document completely dedicated to protecting the rights of your natural person. And as such, none of the human rights listed within it apply to you when you are using your government-issued ID bearing the all-caps name of your artificial person, such as a driver's license. A classic example of this is how a police officer can legally get away with tasering a mother in front of her terrified children during a routine traffic stop.
I handed him my license and registration, and as he started to walk back towards his car, I got out of my car under the impression or hoping that he was going to show me the camera tape. He asked me to get back in my car, and I again said, "Show me the tape, please show me the tape." He asked me to get back in the car, and then he pulled out his taser and said I was under arrest. I said, "Don't do this in front of my kids." I got back in the car, and he said he wanted me back out of the car now. And I said, "Why am I under arrest? I've done nothing wrong. I wasn't speeding. I wasn't on my cell phone." He then yanked me out of the car and wanted me to go down, put my hands or lie. Pulled his taser out, and the first shot jolted me, and I was trying to get back in the car again because I was scared. And then he yanked me away again, and that's when he tased me, and I went down on the ground. It felt like it was an electrical shock going through you, and I had no control over anything. And he's still trying to get me down to the ground, but I was still being electrified.
Article 3 states,
"Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person."
This means you have the fundamental right to human life, to all forms of freedom, the right to maintain and control your own body, including your DNA, and the right to choose which substances you may or may not wish to put into your human body or penetrate your human flesh. Perhaps the most important article is number 4, which states,
"No one shall be held in slavery or servitude. Slavery and the slave trade shall be prohibited in all their forms."
Now this sounds pretty straightforward. No possibility of loopholes there, right? Bearing in mind that this entire document applies only to natural persons, then legally speaking, slavery and servitude is in fact a perfectly legal act if you are enslaving artificial persons. The way this is achieved is through your voluntary consent to represent the all caps artificial person's name listed on your government issued ID. In Article 6, it states,
"Everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law."
For hundreds of years, human beings have been represented in law by the legal status known as a person. However, prior to the American Civil War, black slaves were considered under law to be property, as opposed to human beings, and as such, they were not recognized as a person before the law. With the supposed abolishment of slavery, all human beings now have the legal right to be recognized as a person before the law. Given that this declaration was written a full 60 years after the creation of the legal status known as an artificial person, it begs the question, why did Article 6 not specify the natural person? The fact is, they left it open for interpretation on purpose. in order to facilitate the elite's goal of deceiving us into consenting to represent the all caps name. Moving on to Article 9.
No one shall be subjected to arbitrary arrest, detention, or exile.
This one is a particularly sore point with me, as I witnessed with my own eyes the arbitrary arrest, detention, and exile of more than 1,100 of my fellow human beings at the Toronto G20 in 2010. 3 years later, of the 1,100 arrests that weekend, less than a dozen cases concluded in a criminal conviction. At the time, I was shocked and outraged. However, I now understand how they were able to do this without a single police officer being fired for violating human rights. The simple fact is, every single one of those arrested human beings produced their government-issued ID for the police to bear witness, at which point they became artificial persons before the law, which, of course, are not protected by the Declaration of Human Rights. Again, remember, the all-capitalized name on your government-issued ID is not you. It is an artificial person that you are falsely identifying with. This leads into Article 11.
Everyone charged with a penal offense has the right to be presumed innocent until proved guilty, according to law, in a public trial at which he has had all the guarantees necessary for his defense.
As stated in Part 1, artificial persons do not have a soul or a conscience, and something that does not have a soul or a conscience cannot possibly have innocence. Article 15.
1. Everyone has the right to a nationality. 2. No one shall be arbitrarily deprived of his nationality, nor denied the right to change his nationality.
Most people associate the word nationality with the word citizenship. These two words are actually completely different concepts in law. Nationality refers to the native soil of the country in which you were born, or to the soil of the country you currently call home, whether you are a citizen or not. Citizenship merely refers to your rights of political affiliation in the country you currently reside, regardless of where you may have been born. In short, everyone has the lawful right to revoke your consent to being a citizen of the country of your birth, without fear of being deported from your native soil. Remember, a citizen is merely a person who owes allegiance to a political community. As it states in Article 15, everyone has the right to a nationality, meaning you have the human right to live on your native soil without fear of being forced into owing allegiance or obedience to a political community. Article 21.
The will of the people shall be the basis of the authority of government. This will shall be expressed in periodic and genuine elections, which shall be by universal and equal suffrage, and shall be held by secret vote or by equivalent free voting procedures.
Watch this video clip and you will understand that the will of the people is being usurped through technology.
Mr. Curtis, would you please state your full name for the record?
My name is Clinton Eugene Curtis.
And where do you reside?
Tallahassee, Florida.
And what is your profession?
I'm a computer programmer.
Would you please speak into the microphone so the audience can hear your testimony?
I'm a computer programmer.
Mr. Curtis, are there programs that can be used to secretly fix elections?
Yes.
How do you know that to be the case?
Because in October of 2000, I wrote a prototype for President Congressman Tom Feeney at the company I work for in Oviedo, Florida, that did just that.
And when you say did just that, it would rig an election?
It would flip the vote 51-49 to whoever you wanted it to go to and whichever race you wanted to win.
And would that program that you designed be something that elections officials that might be on county boards of elections could detect?
They'd never see it.
Mr. Would you answer that question once again?
They would never see it.
Articles 22 through 29 deal with your human rights should you voluntarily choose to be a person who is a part of a political community, legally termed a citizen, to which you will end up owing allegiance and obedience to the government as a sacrifice so that the state can protect you like a child. And lastly, Article 30 is merely a disclaimer stating,
nothing in this declaration may be interpreted as implying for any state, group, or person any right to engage in any activity or to perform any act aimed at the destruction of any of the rights and freedoms set forth herein.
With an understanding of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it then also becomes much easier to understand human rights documents from your own country. For example, in 1960, Queen Elizabeth II signed into law the Canadian Bill of Rights. Much like the Declaration of Human Rights, this document does not apply to artificial persons, as it is only intended to list the legal rights of natural persons within Canada. And much like the Declaration of Human Rights, the elite's moral code was also behind the creation of this document, as they knew they had a moral and legal obligation to put down on paper a list of our human rights that were eventually going to be suppressed through the use of the artificial person. The preamble reads, "The Parliament of Canada, affirming that the Canadian nation is founded upon the principles that acknowledge the supremacy of God, the dignity and worth of the human person, and the position of the family in a society of free men and free institutions. Affirming also that men and institutions remain free only when freedom is founded upon respect for moral and spiritual values and the rule of law." Again, we see the introduction of the natural person with the phrase, dignity and worth of the human person. However, even more compelling than that is the admission that the Canadian nation is founded upon the principles that acknowledge the supremacy of God. In this hierarchy system, human beings in Canada are second only to God, and as such, governments and their employees are actually beneath us. They are our servants. The Canadian Bill of Rights reads in part, "It is hereby recognized and declared that in Canada there have existed and shall continue to exist without discrimination by reason of race, national origin, color, religion, or sex, the following human rights and fundamental freedoms, namely, A, the right of the individual to life, liberty, security of the person, and enjoyment of property, and the right not to be deprived thereof except by due process of law. B, the right of the individual to equality before the law and protection of the law. C, freedom of religion. D, freedom of speech. E, freedom of assembly and association, and F, freedom of the press. These are just some of the rights human beings in Canada have, merely by virtue of having been born free on this soil. These rights were not given to us by the government. They are inherent natural rights that you were born with and can never be removed without your consent. Fast forward 22 years. On the 17th of April, 1982, the Canadian nation was transformed into a corporation by Prime Minister of Canada, Pierre Elliott Trudeau. At this point, the Constitution Act of Canada was amended and transformed into a corporate charter, adding to it the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, a document of incorporation that, according to Section 32, only applies to employees of this new corporate government. As the Canadian Heritage website explained, the purpose of this section was to make it clear that the charter only applies to governments and not to private individuals, businesses, or other organizations. The word charter has many different legal definitions, However, in the case of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, it is defined in law as an instrument that establishes a body politic or other organization, or that grants rights, liberties, or powers to its citizens or members. The word grant is defined in law as to permit something. And as we all know, permit is the root of the word permission. Let's read that again, this time substituting the word grants for the word permits. A charter is an instrument that establishes a body politic or other organization, or that permits rights, liberties, or powers to its citizens or members. Upon understanding this, you may begin to see that in 1982, Canada was transformed into a lesser form of communism, one that recognizes certain human freedoms, but also permits other rights in the form of privileges doled out by the government. What can you do with a privilege that you can't do with a human right? Take it away. In fact, the word human does not even appear once in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, as compared to appearing four times in the Canadian Bill of Rights. The reason for this is because Prime Minister Trudeau never intended for this document to apply strictly to human beings. The Canadian Bill of Rights is designed to protect the rights of human beings in the form of natural persons, whereas the Charter of Rights and Freedoms muddies the water by combining the rights of both natural and artificial persons, and protecting them both simultaneously, with virtually no legal distinction between the two. The preamble to the Charter reads, "Whereas Canada is founded upon the principles that recognize the supremacy of God and the rule of law." Compare this to the preamble of the Canadian Bill of Rights, which reads, "The Parliament of Canada, affirming that the Canadian nation is founded upon the principles that acknowledge the supremacy of God, the dignity and worth of the human person, and the position of the family in a society of free men and free institutions. Affirming also that men and institutions remain free only when freedom is founded upon respect for moral and spiritual values and the rule of law." Canadian nation refers not only to the landmass known as Canada, but also refers to the free human beings living on the landmass that collectively make up its government. Whereas Canada, as written in the Charter, refers only to the corporation known as Canada, which was established in 1982. The second major difference we notice is that the preamble of the Charter is much shorter and, legally speaking, omits many unnecessary words such as dignity, human, family, and freedom. Section 2 of the Charter is entitled Fundamental Freedoms, which reads, "Everyone has the following fundamental freedoms: A. Freedom of conscience and religion, B. Freedom of thought, belief, opinion, and expression, including freedom of the press and other media of communication, C. Freedom of peaceful assembly, and D. Freedom of association." You may notice something missing from this as compared to the Bill of Rights: the right to life, liberty, and property, etc. This right has been moved to Section 7 under the heading Legal Rights. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, and the right not to be deprived thereof, except in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. Compare this to the Bill of Rights, which states, "The right to the individual, to life, liberty, security of the person, and enjoyment of property, and the right not to be deprived thereof, except by due process of law." Immediately, we notice three major differences. Number one, the right of the individual versus the word everyone. In law, the word individual refers to the natural person only, whereas the word everyone means every person. And in this context, it refers to both types of persons, natural and artificial. Number two is the complete removal from the corporate charter of the right to the enjoyment of property. The reason for this omission is due to the fact that the charter is generally meant for both types of persons equally. And the simple fact is, artificial persons do not have the human right to enjoyment or ownership of property. And the third major difference is the term due process of law versus the term fundamental justice. Due process is defined in law as the conduct of legal proceedings according to established rules and principles for the protection and enforcement of private rights. Fundamental justice is a term that is not defined in any law dictionary that I have read, but is defined on Wikipedia as a legal term, although closely associated with, is not to be confused with the concept of due process. Once again, the reason for the substitution is due to the fact that the charter is designed to protect both natural and artificial persons simultaneously. Due process only applies to the private rights of natural persons, whereas the charter applies to both public and private rights, hence the made-up term fundamental justice, which legally covers both public and private systems. The bottom line is, in Canada, if you are appearing in court as the representative for your artificial person, then you are only entitled to fundamental justice. However, if you are appearing in court as your natural person, your legal rights are fully protected by due process of law. The choice is yours. Choose wisely.
In recent decades, worldwide social change has experienced unprecedented historical acceleration, particularly because instant mass communications, such as radio, television, and the internet, cumulatively have been stimulating a universal awakening of mass political consciousness. Persistent and highly motivated populist resistance of politically awakened and historically resentful peoples to external control has proven to be increasingly difficult to suppress.
In the last 5 years, I have grown by leaps and bounds. I am no longer a child in the eyes of the law, and as a result, I no longer fear any civil servant, including the ones with guns. More importantly, I have learned to govern myself rather than allowing my artificial person to govern me. And as such, I am more spiritually and mentally prepared to peacefully resist the One World Company Limited, using research, education, and knowledge as my weapons of choice. If you truly desire to be free and are willing to put the effort into educating yourself, it will happen. All journeys begin with just one step, and the first step on this journey is letting go of the fear. This is the fundamental truth that my many years of research have taught me. We are governed by consent, and we are policed by consent. I hereby withdraw my consent. This is the fundamental human freedom that awaits all of us.